everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. It is always a treat when you drop into the neighborhood. And today I brought a couch for you because you're going to need it. We're going to have a little bit of fun with a wonderful guy, professor, and a thinker about things that I think you're going to find a little bit intriguing, as I noted coming into the show. First, I just want to thank everybody for being a part of the conversation. You can find us on Spreaker, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcast on. You know that. Follow me on Twitter at Michael Steele. And if you like this episode, please comment on it on the Spreaker app. It helps me to know your thoughts. So let's just get into it. I'm really excited to welcome Steven Pinker, who is an experimental psychologist. All right. And those are two words you generally don't put together in the same sentence. But this man has made a phenomenal career out of conducting research in visual cognitions, psycholinguistics, that's a mouthful, Steve, and social relations. He grew up in Montreal and earned his BA from McGill and his PhD from Harvard. So, you know, he's got some bona fides. Currently, he's a John Stone Professor of Psychology at Harvard. And he has also taught at Stanford and MIT. So this brother, he's got it, right? But what we wanted to get into is his 12th book, which is out now. It came out in September. It's called Rationality: What It Is, Why It Seems Scarce, and Why It Matters. Steve, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you.
I love the way... this all kind of comes together, because one of the things that I've been struggling with is the rationality behind a lot of, not just, I mean, it's easy to kind of sort of figure out sort of the Trumpian nature of things in our politics. But even when you look at how rationality and what the sense of being rational is, or at least what we thought it was, plays out in COVID, plays out in our response to our neighbors and communities in which we've lived for generations. What is it that you see right now? We are a species that create vaccines in less than a year, that do so many great things, but yet we seem to fall into this irrational space. What's up with that?
Well, that was the challenge that I took on when I wrote the book. I'm a cognitive psychologist, so I study how the mind works. That's what I get paid to do. But the question of are we a rational or an irrational species is a tough one to answer. But it's easy to say, oh, well, we're just filled with biases and shortcuts, and we evolved from, you know, cavemen who had to escape from tigers on the savannah, and you know, all of that. And there's a grain of truth to that, but it can't be the whole story because, you know, for one thing, as you note, we did invent vaccine for a new disease in less than a year. We've explored the cosmos. We understand the basis of life, of neural networks in the brain. Even to say humans are irrational, well, that implies that there is some standard or benchmark of rationality that we can understand, that against which we can compare, you know, ordinary schlemiels. If we say they're not rational, it raises the question, well, what is rationality? And how do you know what it is? So, I mean, if we can say this is rational and that's what people do, we got to be capable of rationality. It's not like we have some council of an advanced race of space aliens that are telling us what's rational.
Really? Really? Look, dude, I watch enough of these programs to know that there's maybe something out there pulling some strings. But look, you actually put your finger on something interesting. But who gets to decide what's rational? Is it really smart guys like yourself who kind of observe the culture, the society, and all the elements therein? And sort of draw that line, or do we, as you know, the coming out of the primordial soup and goop over time, develop what's rational?
Well, I think we all are born with enough rationality to negotiate the world. The people who believe in the craziest conspiracy theories, you know, they show up to work on time and they keep gas in the car and they get the kids clothed and fed and off to school. So it's not as if they're out of touch with reality, or psychotic. It's so here's how I try to make sense of it. when it comes to our everyday lives, the kind of concrete things around us, we're all pretty rational. And even the hunter-gatherers from which we evolved, I mean, they're pretty clever. It's not as if they were just running away from cheetahs all the time and leopards. They had to apply a lot of brain power to outsmart the animals that are a lot faster, a lot stronger, a lot fiercer than them. But they track them from their footprints. They extract poisons that they put on the tips of their arrows. They ambush them. They set up snares. I mean, our species is really, really smart when it comes to surviving in our physical environment. But then there are some issues that become kind of symbols of our moral identity that, at least for most of us, you know, unless you're a mover and a shaker, you know, your opinion on, you know, climate change, your opinion on evolution, it kind of doesn't matter. Your life's mm-hmm. going to go the same way no matter what you believe. And people treat those beliefs as signs of what's right and wrong, who they are, who their tribe is, who their enemies are. And there, people don't necessarily hold beliefs because they're true or false. They hold them to indicate their moral bona fides. So if someone says, you know, I think that Hillary Clinton ran a child sex ring out of the basement of a Washington pizzeria, what they're really saying is, boo, Hillary. Or if, you know, if someone says that the, you know,
I think that may be a little bit better to say it that way than say the woman is running a child pornography ring.
It would be, exactly. But the idea, you know, the idea that you should only believe things for which you have good reasons.
Yeah.
That might just seem like obvious, like, well, duh. Yeah.
Right.
But no, that is a radical manifesto. That's, I think a gift of the Enlightenment. It's not the way most people work when it comes to beliefs that don't impinge on their everyday lives. Sometimes even beliefs that do impinge on their everyday lives can be infected by this kind of tribalism, by beliefs as a symbol of what side are you on, as when people avoid vaccines and, you know, many of whom die of COVID. So it can penetrate your everyday life.
Okay, so let's draw the line on rationality between someone who avoids vaccines because there is maybe a book of science that sort of justifies that belief, right? Maybe there's a medical relationship that they are familiar with that, you know, it may be in their family or themselves personally that makes them. So there's a rational basis for that to argue versus the person who says that Hillary Clinton is running a, you know, child porn ring out of a pizza in the back room of a pizza parlor. How do you get there? Because the person who makes the claim about Hillary, obviously that's not rational. All right. There is no basis in fact. There's no basis in science. There's no basis in, observation, meaning I was at the pizza parlor and I saw her head into the back room. Right. So what's the difference? We, as a society, we look at both of those, particularly in the COVID environment. We still look at the people who may hold that, quote, rational view of vaccines as somewhat being irrational. Yeah. In light of what we know about it and how it's being played out nationally. In the same vein, we see the Hillary narrative told by some numbnut, you know, who's had a little bit too much of whatever. we see that as irrational. So how do we draw the same, you know, view of irrationality around one thing that could be really rational and the other that we know not to be?
Yeah, well, you know, at this point, avoiding vaccines is not quite like believing that Hillary ran a child sex ring, but it's close. I mean, the evidence is just so massive. But you raise the crucial question, and it's related to the question you asked before, namely, you know, who decides? And the answer, of course, is, you know, is no one. We don't have a priesthood We don't have a pope of science. We don't have an absolute dictator. I mean, we know what happens when you do. You get authority saying, well, the sun goes around the earth, or the earth is 5,000 years old, or Kim Jong-un has divine powers.
Right.
That having any kind of authority in charge of the truth, given that we're all humans, we're all flawed, is just not the way to do it. There has to be kind of a community of people who can criticize each other and can show their work, can explain the reasons behind their recommendations. That's the way, ideally science works. And we don't have a scientific czar. We've got, scientists will share their best assessment, mm-hmm. but if anyone wants to criticize a scientific consensus, they can. They don't get fired, they don't get burned at the stake. And in that debate, that rough and tumble, that competition among ideas, the truth, or at least our best approximation to the truth, gradually emerges. But it can always be revised because, no one's infallible. No one's omniscient. It's always you always have to make an argument for their position. What's happened?
I was going to ask you, what's your argument then for rationality? How do you make it?
Yeah.
How do you make that argument?
It's a funny thing to argue for, because if you're arguing about anything, you've kind of already lost. That is, you're already conceding that rationality is the yardstick by which mm-hmm. we measure ideas, because, as long as you're not, threatening someone, believe this or I'll throw you in jail, or bribing someone, believe this and I'll give you $10,000. You're saying, here are the reasons why you should believe it. Well, reasons why, that's rationality. Rationality is like it's the air we breathe, it's the water we swim in. It's something that you kind of can't get out of. Now, that having been said, it's not just a, arbitrary rule book, like the rules of, Major League Baseball, because we also know that it works. Namely, when we try to be rational, we actually do get to the moon. We actually do eliminate smallpox.
Right.
We do develop antibiotics that work. We do invent cars and smartphones. So it tells us that we're kind of on the right track. And, we know that we know what it's like to be in a world that's not rational, when we fall asleep and dream, where we get transported from one place to another and miracles right. happen. And everyday life isn't like that. Things are pretty predictable, and the world of science and engineering is really the world that we live in. So the crucial question is, given that we really are descendants of cavemen, mm-hmm. We do have institutions like science, like responsible journalism, like liberal democracy, like a court system, that are imperfect, but they're better than just asking some guy on the street. How do people come to trust the institutions that deserve trust to the right. extent that they do? Because none of us knows enough science to evaluate these recommendations on their own. I do believe that human activity is burning fossil fuels is warming the planet, but mm-hmm. I'm not an atmospheric chemist. Mm-hmm. I believe that vaccines do prevent polio and smallpox and whooping cough and COVID. I'm not a virologist, and in fact, there are kind of primitive intuitions that all of us have that push us in the wrong direction in a scientifically sophisticated society. Like, gee, you shouldn't inject a disease agent into your flesh.
Right.
That's a pretty powerful intuition.
Or Clorox, for that matter. But that's
Or Clorox. On the other hand, if you do inject instructions for antigens to COVID, that actually does prevent COVID.
Right.
Our intuitions, our gut feeling, our primitive, lizard brain tells us not to. people have opposed vaccines ever since vaccines were invented, just because they seem to go against common sense. But if you're in a scientifically sophisticated society, you have to learn to to set aside your common sense, because your common sense tells you that the earth goes around the sun. Your common sense can be wrong. And a big problem is, How does science, how does government agencies, how does journalism maintain the trust of the population, which, you know, they've been having trouble doing. People aren't don't trust science and government and journalism the way they used to.
But that's not rational.
Well, it isn't in the to the extent, I mean, it is rational to kind of be skeptical of everything, but it's not it's not rational to be skeptical of things that actually have proven that they work.
Yeah, but that's really where I was going to, because in the main, Stephen, you have doctors and researchers and scientists and others, both inside and outside of the medical profession, the research profession, that have developed these vaccines and medicines and so forth that, by and large, we trust. When the doctor prescribes the pill or prescribes the shot, right? Taking it out of a COVID, but just some, every day you go to the doctor and he says, look, I'm going to need to give you a shot for this. You don't sit there and go, oh, hell no. You know, you don't sit there and go through this irrational response. So why is it?
It's exactly right. So you have a urinary tract infection. You know, you don't have antibiotic resistors.
Right.
So some issues just get politicized. They become identity badges. Now, I think they're helped along by certain primitive intuitions, like you don't inject stuff into your body. And if people haven't unlearned those intuitions, then they'll be susceptible to these identity beliefs. But beliefs can be politicized. And so vaccination had the bad luck, unlike, say, antibiotics, where, you know, almost no one is opposed to antibiotics.
Right.
On principle, you don't have demonstrations and resistors. Hey, people just take the bloody things because they work.
I'm marching against penicillin. I mean, it just doesn't.
Yeah. You know, exactly. So the what happens though is sometimes issues become identity badges for moral and political coalitions.
Right.
It happened to climate change. It happened to COVID and vaccines. Happens to some small number of issues. And so as one article put it, politics makes you stupid. and you know, we know this.
My wife has been saying that for a long time now.
Well, when I say that, and then, you know, no offense. I know it's what you've done.
That's kind of what I do. And I'm kind of stupid for doing it, I guess.
Yes. So I don't mean, here's what I mean when I say that. What I mean is, you give people, this is experiments that have been done. So you give people like little logic problems. You know, P implies Q, P therefore Q. But, you know, P implies Q, Q, no, not therefore P. So, I mean, these are the kinds of things you learn in elementary logic. Now, instead of P and Q, you put in things like, you know, affirmative action or gun control. Then what happens is the liberals are logical when the problem supports a liberal position, and they're illogical when it supports the conservative position, and right wing, and vice versa when you flip them around.
Right.
And we also know that if you take the same policy position and you say, this is what, this is Hillary's solution to healthcare versus this is, you know, Mitt Romney's solution to healthcare, even if it's the same policy, just introducing it that way. And people will say, you know, depending on whether the left or the right, they'll say, oh yes, great idea. Or, oh no, that will never work. That's totally unacceptable. So that's what I mean when I say, and people actually, this has been shown, people literally make math errors when they're asked to, and smart people, not just stupid people, smart people who are good at math will make math errors if you give them, you know, data that supports the position they don't believe in. So if you say, here's a study on gun control, and you give them data that shows that gun control doesn't work.
Right.
And the conservatives become geniuses. They say, oh yes, that validates the position, and then the liberals become dunces. Then you flip around the data, and it's the other way around.
Right.
Now the conservatives are the dunces, and the liberals are the geniuses.
So what does that tell you?
One does the math. They just go directly to the conclusion. Is this a conclusion that supports my belief or not?
So is that what is driving a lot of what we see now today? We kind of put it in the term of tribalism. Me and mine, we all agree, we all are of the same thinking and idea about a certain issue or issues. Is that what's driving a lot of this right now? Is this sort of tribalism that forces us, smart people to be dumb and dumb people to be, well, just a little bit
dumber? Or at
least
right sometimes.
Yes. Or at least right sometimes, yeah.
Right. I think that's an awful lot of it, yeah. And it's something that, which means that, you know, those of us both on the right and the left who ultimately want to do what's best for the country, what's best for human beings, should try to depoliticize beliefs as much as we can. And I think that both the left and the right have been at fault for not doing that, for allowing politics to creep in. You know, I think when many people who are activists for dealing with climate change, for example, will say that one of the worst things that happened to the movement was when Al Gore did An Inconvenient Truth. Yep. Not because he was necessarily wrong, but because he was the Democratic vice president and then presidential candidate, he kind of branded it a left-wing issue. And that meant that people on the right had to, whatever it was, they had to oppose it.
Right.
And that, you know, that actually could have led to more harm just because it did brand it. And I see that, you know, I work in a university, and so, you know, the majority of the people that I rub shoulders with are on the left. But I think they make terrible mistakes when they themselves politicize issues because they repel people who aren't on the left. And that's just a tactical mistake.
You talk about in your book, rationality. You say that rationality, really kind of gets into this sort of national pursuit of self-interest, sectarian solidarity, all those things that tribalism, uplifting mythology, those types of things that ultimately wind up crippling the society that we live in. What are the norms then to correct that? What should we be looking to put in place?
Yeah.
To sort of self-correct, if you will, for our somewhat irrational behavior.
Yes. Well, we should be, there's kind of a mindset that's sometimes called active open-mindedness, which is you constantly challenge your own beliefs, you look at evidence, you're prepared to change your mind. Now, for a lot of people, that's a sign of weakness. That's, you know, flip-flopping. But in fact, since, you know, none of us is an angel, none of us is perfect, none of us is omniscient, none of us is a genius, the rational thing to do is always to be open to changing your mind to the best evidence, that it's just not going to be true that your own coalition is always going to be correct about everything, or that you yourself are always going to be correct about everything. There's that overall mindset. There's also certain just, you know, tools, cognitive tools, I call them, that just overcome the fact that our minds are kind of rooted in the concrete physical present, but, you know, we can do better. We've got, you know, hundreds, thousands of years of, you know, mathematics and science and logic. So I tend to think that everyone should be aware of, you know, some logic, some, you know, the concept of probability. Mm-hmm. There's a tool of probability that's, when I describe it, it's going to sound fancier than it is. It's called Bayes' rule or Bayes' theorem, B-A-Y-E-S. Mm-hmm. Now that makes it sound like some kind of fancy schmancy mathematics. It's actually pretty simple. And I try to explain it in the in one of the chapters of rationality. Mm-hmm. There's how do you distinguish correlation and causation? There's game theory, namely what's the most rational thing to do if the outcome depends on what other rational people do. Like if you're playing, you know, scissors, paper, rock, or mm-hmm. Or chicken, or where it's not just about you, but it also depends on the other guy, and each one of you's got to kind of outpsych the other. Anyway, these are a bunch of kind of cognitive tools that I kind of think should be taught in school. If they're not taught in school by and large, but you know, I do try to explain them in the book.
Right.
So that's another part of the answer. But probably the biggest is to be actively open-minded, to be prepared to, as there's a famous quote from the economist, John Maynard Keynes. Turns out he never said it, but it's a good quote anyway. He was accused of flip-flopping, and he said, "Well, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir?" Now, you know, that's the right attitude, and you know, whether or not Keynes himself said it.
Right, right.
You know, most quotes weren't said by the people that everyone quotes, like, you know, Mark Twain and Yogi Berra.
Right, right.
But be that as it may, it's a good quote.
It's a good quote. It works for the moment. We are having a great conversation with professor of psychology at Harvard University, our buddy Steven Pinker. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to apply some of these, some of this rationality to some very irrational stuff that we've seen recently in our politics and our culture. We'll be back with more right after this.
I'm Dr. Andrew Jacobs, host of the Sports Psychology Hour. Is your New Year's resolution to become stronger, healthier, and more resilient? Then start with the Rewire Fitness Neuro Performance app. Rewire Fitness takes a holistic approach to achieving peak performance, letting you strengthen both your body and mind with Rewire's integrated resilience training system. Go to winnersunlimited.com/rewire. Click Learn More to sign up for your free 7-day trial of Rewire Fitness. That's winnersunlimited.com/rewire.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. Michael Steele, and we're having a wonderful conversation with Steven Pinker. He is the author of the new book, Rationality, What It Is, Why It Seems Scarce, Why It Matters. He is a professor, a Johnstone professor of psychology at Harvard University. He has taught at Stanford, MIT, so he's got all of that. And he's here with us. And yeah, we're on the couch, folks, because I'm trying to understand, as he's written about and sort of explored the idea of rationality, trying to be rational human beings in a space where there's not a whole lot of that seeming to be applied. I come to the conclusion in sort of looking at a lot of the political and cultural behavior over the past few years, particularly in the space that I work in politics, and ask the question, how do you reason someone out of a position that they haven't reasoned themselves into? And I think he would be the perfect person to answer that question for me.
Yes.
because when I sit there, I've listened to people, Professor, go back and forth trying to understand the Trump voter, trying to understand why, you know, Republicans have lost their damn mind and why Democrats are behaving like they have no clue what's going on politically and culturally in the country, et cetera. And it all obviously sort of, you know, is driven by our politics, which is the first problem. It used to be our culture, our science, our ethics, all of these things sort of set up and drove the politics, right? The politicians would then sort of replicate the cultural attitudes and try to, you know, apply them to policy and apply them. Now it is the reverse, where that politics seems to be driving the culture and driving our responses to a lot of things. What is going on there? How do you reason people into and out of positions that they haven't themselves already reasoned into?
Yeah, it's the great question. It's an important question, and you know, and I wish I had a completely satisfying answer. But you know, in some
right,
cases,
so I'm going to need to put morning coffee in my mug at this point, right?
You know, in some cases, the answer is you can't. So if you would ask me the question, how do I convince the Pope that Jesus did not, you know, rise from the dead? I'd say,
but that's I got that, but wait a minute now, I got that, and because that's going to faith, that's going to
exactly
faith, tradition, belief. You know, following Donald Trump isn't an article of faith.
Well, that's the problem.
Or am I wrong?
Well, that's the problem. It kind of is.
Okay.
So that is the problem. And, you know, for some people, it's going to be impossible. As we know, it's, you know, as is often said, Trump has become a cult of personality. He's thought of as a by some as a kind of messianic figure. I actually once had a taxi driver that I was talking with who said that he thinks that God delivered Donald Trump to Earth to, you know, save the country. So there actually are people who believe that, oh, or something close to it. However,
you
this doesn't mean
to pull over
just...
at that point and just get out of the cab. Yeah, just...
right here.
Yeah, you can just pull over at the next corner. I'm good. I'll walk.
Yeah, probably that probably was good advice. But you know, so there are so part of. However, it doesn't mean that it's just going to has to therefore be a war. A religious war. The Protestants against the Catholics or the Hindus against the Muslims.
Right.
Because not everyone is a true believer. There are people who are in the kind of the gray area where it's not black or not or white, and they can be peeled off by arguments and evidence. There are, you know, new babies born all the time, and they don't, you know, come into the world supporting Donald Trump or Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez or anyone.
Right.
And you know, they can be persuaded. In addition to, you know, just old-fashioned attempts to persuade with, you know, logic and evidence, we should be aware of people's moral identity, the fact that there is this phenomenon of tribalism that pushes against just accepting the best evidence, and to try not to politicize issues if we can avoid it, to try to the institutions that are our best way of kind of getting out of our tribalism, out of our primitive, caveman intuitions. Institutions like science, like a free press, the court system, government agencies, they do have to work at constantly reestablishing their credibility. You know, they've got to show their work in the sense, you know, the same way your math teacher asks you to show your work. You don't just give the answer, you show how you arrived.
Oh, I always hated that, dude. I always hated that. I was like, when I would do the math problem and I just put the answer down and get the paper back, you got to show the work. I'm like, no, because I know.
Right.
No, I don't want to show
the
work.
But our scientists, our public health experts, they should show their work. Because it shouldn't just be, trust me, I'm a scientist.
Right.
It should be, look, here are the studies. Here's what happens if you do this. Here's what happens if you do that.
But Stephen, when you do that, and this goes to what we were just talking about reason and rationality and taking these positions, in the face of all of that, you know, you've got this cab driver that you ran into who says that he believed God put Trump here to save the world or save America. What the hell is he based that on? Where in scripture, where in faith tradition, where in any catechetical understanding does Donald Trump's name even come up in the context of saving us from whatever? How do people make this leap? Because for me, I run into people like that cab driver. I'm just saying, you're full of crap. You are, quote, rationalizing yourself or a position or a point of view to justify right now the level of stupidity that you are otherwise showing family and friends and neighbors. Because maybe I'm being irrational and more emotional about it, but it, you know, I consider myself a sentient being. I consider myself rational about these things. It's kind of how my mother raised me in many respects. So I do get that, and I do step back and I go, all right, fine. But then there's some points where I just draw the line and go, no, I'm not buying that bull. I'm not buying it. I'm just not going to sit here and let you tell me, as someone who spent years in a monastery, who almost, you know, studied to be a priest, that you can find a rational theological reason to utter the foolishness you just uttered.
Right. Well, I'm totally sympathetic with what you said. It probably takes like...
You can see I need a couch to lie on it from time to time.
No. I mean, it requires, you know, massive self-control not to say what you just said. So the question
is,
I guess the challenge is,
yeah,
you know, in some cases, just the signal, like, you know, I'm not going to pretend to know the answer.
Right.
So in some cases, the signal, look, that's idiotic. You're being a fool. Maybe for some people and for bystanders, for people who see what's going on, that would give them some inhibition against embracing nonsense.
So shouldn't we say that more, Stephen? Shouldn't we, as a culture and a community? This is one of the problems I have with my party right now, relative to its statement this past week of, oh yeah, January 6th was just legitimate political discourse. That's not rational in the face of what we saw. So why don't we push back on that culturally and politically and economically, socially, or whatever means available? Why do people now find themselves adopting irrational views or positions, and then we allowing that to sort of fester in the cultural ether?
Yeah, I totally agree that we have to push back. And the question is really kind of a question of tactics.
Okay.
That is, what is the most effective way of doing it? And, you know, I don't know what the mixture is between saying, are you stark raving mad? Or
that would be me. That would be my mixture.
Well, it requires a lot of self-control not to say that. I agree. Or, you know, are there more subtle, tactful routes to do that? Like, well, how do you know that? What makes you think that? Gee, doesn't this seem to contradict that? And, you know, unfortunately, I wish I knew the route to doing it. What is the mixture of tactics of persuasion, ridicule, you know, seduction, how you do that? That's probably more in your area of expertise than mine, in the sense of the art of politics and persuasion and coalition building.
That's gone. That art is almost lost these days on a significant number of people. I mean, we're talking, close to, 100 million people, a third of our country, if not more, sort of falling into this sort of irrational sort of reality of how we see not just the politics, but what we're seeing play out culturally today. I mean, the way we look at each other and describe each other is as if we're completely foreign to who they are. And I'm talking about people who look at their family members that way. People look at their grandmama like, I don't know who the hell that woman is. You know? It's like, what's driving some of that, do you think?
Again, I mean, it is one of the questions of the era, and I think we don't know completely. The easy answer is, social media, everyone's in a filter bubble. And there's probably something to that, but it's very easy to go into a filter bubble without social media. Like if you only subscribe to right-wing papers or left-wing papers or right-wing cable news or left-wing cable news. And I suspect that talk radio and cable news have a larger effect in this kind of polarization than Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. That's part of the answer. Another part is there are ways in which socially we become more segregated. The people who go to get a university education move into downtown areas, aren't rubbing shoulders with the people who stay in the more rural areas and outer suburbs. And the old organizations that used to bring people together, like churches and bowling leagues and volunteer service organizations, have all kind of declined. And so people just aren't interacting day to day with people from different walks of life. So I think that's another part of our problem. There could be also features in our democratic system that need to be tinkered with. It maybe are kind of pushing us to be more polarized than a better system. And sometimes some people have argued that instead of having congressional districts, each one of which has a single representative and then subject to gerrymandering, that if we had districts that had several larger districts with several representatives, then you wouldn't have politicians being incentivized to just appeal to the largest coalition that will push them over the top.
Right.
They've got to kind of have positions that appeal even to people that aren't already in their corner. And there may be things like features of our system, like lifetime tenure for Supreme Court justices, the Electoral College, first past the post voting, where whoever, you know, if there are three candidates and one gets 34%, then they're in, even if, you know, if 66% of the people oppose them. So there may be features in the system that could be reformed that would help us as well.
I thought, well, one of my favorite chapters in the book, it was actually, I gravitated to it immediately just by the title, What's Wrong with People?
And I knew that was the one that everyone would go to first.
You know, it's like when you pick the book up, folks, you kind of go through it. And I saw that, I said, I'm starting there because I just need to know before I get, you know, get into the, on the road with the science and the data and all of that. Tell us what you were thinking in that chapter. There was a lot, I mean, there's a lot, for example, I'll pull it up. It says COVID quackery, climate denial, conspiracy theories are symptoms of what some are calling an epistemological crisis and a quote, post-truth era. Another symptom is fake news. In the second decade of the 21st century, social media have become sluices for torrents of tall tales like these. Pope Francis shocks world, endorses Donald Trump for president. Yoko Ono, quote, I had an affair with Hillary Clinton in the 1970s. And it kind of goes on from there. Also rampant are beliefs in ghouls, black magic, and other superstitions. Now, I believe in ghosts. I think they're real. As you mentioned in the first chapter, 3/4 of Americans hold at least some paranormal belief. But hell, we're seeing some of the science back some of that up. Same thing with, you know, our government now telling us, or at least hinting, yeah, there may be a little ET out there that we should be aware of. Where do we draw those lines? In answering the question, what's wrong with people, where do you, as a scientist who studies human behavior, who's looking for rational thought and connective, you know, reasons for some of the things we do or don't do, where do we draw those lines and how are those lines drawn?
Yeah, so that chapter has basically been what you and I have been talking about during this conversation.
Right.
We haven't spent that much time on, you know, Bayes' rule and statistics and, you know, logical.
Let's get to what the hell's wrong with people?
That's what we've been talking about. We've already covered a lot of the that content, but the answer is we should look at our best science, while challenging scientists to show their work, like how right. do you know, why do you say this? How do you know? And that tells us there is no ESP, forget it. There's no clairvoyance. You can't move objects with sheer mental power. There's no crystal energy in pyramids or crystals.
Right.
Part of it is you just know enough. There should be enough scientific literacy just to know what are the forces of the universe. Also, and this is perhaps even more crucial, what are the cognitive traps that that make people believe in paranormal woo-woo and telepathy and all of these things that our science says doesn't exist? And there are several mental traps. So I'll just give you an example. So a psychic, a seer, it turns out 5 years ago they predicted that there'd be a terrorist attack let's say before 9/11, they predicted that sometime there'd be a terrorist attack.
Right.
You say, aha, that shows that psychic powers exist. Well, yeah, but then if you go back to that psychic's track record, all of the predictions that didn't come true, and if you look at how vague the prediction was, well, sometime in the future.
Yeah, sometime in the future, there's going to be a terrorist attack.
You realize that, that one of our fallacies is failing to distinguish between prior and after the fact predictions. Mm-hmm. That is, hindsight is 20/20. If you just get to check someone's track record from the true predictions, but you don't look at all the false predictions, it's a fallacy called confirmation bias.
Yep.
Then you can see through a lot of these bogus claims. Or if you know that you always have to distinguish correlation from causation, and it's all not so easy. So does coffee cause heart attacks? Well, coffee drinkers have more heart attacks, and that proves it, right? Well, no, wait a second. Maybe people who drink a lot of coffee also don't exercise much and are more likely to smoke. Maybe it's the smoking that causes the heart attack, and the coffee has nothing to do with it. It's
right.
It's a confound. It's correlated but not causal. So a lot of these tools of sound reasoning, which I explain in the rest of the book, kind of inoculate you. They're almost like a cognitive vaccine, a mental vaccine against a lot of the pseudoscience, the hippy dippy, paranormal, new age, you know, crystal power, woo-woo right. stuff.
Interesting. So one last question as we get up out of here, and it relates back to your 2018 book, Enlightenment. Enlightenment Now. You write then that life on Earth is improving, right? Do you feel equally hopeful about the future after what we've witnessed over the last few years and where we are right now since 2018 when you wrote those words that, you know, life on Earth is improving?
Yeah. It's a mixed picture. I mean, I base that conclusion, as I then kind of explained in the very last chapter on rationality, not because I believe that there's anything called progress, like this mystical force that
right sort of lifts us up and all right.
No, forget none of that. it's not because I think we should be an optimist and just, you know, always see the glass as half full. It's just that the data show that we live longer. There are fewer poor people, there are fewer famines, there are fewer wars. And so the evidence suggests that progress, at least so far, on average, you know, not everywhere, but on average has occurred. What is responsible for it? Well, I say it's kind of rationality. When people apply their brain power to solving problems like disease and hunger and war and crime, gradually, you know, every once in a while, we hit upon something that works. We try not to repeat our mistakes, and right. that's what makes progress possible. So the question is, are those conditions still occurring? Are the tools for progress still in place? And it's a mixed picture. Our science is going great guns. So right. I think scientific progress will continue. Democracy, liberal democracy, which I think is another driver of progress, you know, it's being challenged in Russia, in Hungary, in Turkey, and to some extent in the United States. Let's hope that the forces that keep democracy going will prevail. War, well, we're seeing a big challenge, a big threat now in
Ukraine,
Putin, who in some ways is a throwback. I mean, the way the
world... Oh, he is. Total throwback.
Total throwback, yeah. Yeah. So I'm, you know, I kind of am disappointed that nightmare of the past, the idea there should be spheres of influence and national greatness, as opposed to just letting people live their lives and earn money and be happy. So that's kind of a pushing in the wrong direction. So the way I put it is I'd be conditional optimist, not a naive optimist. Namely, we do have the tools. If we apply them, then I think that things can continue to improve.
Well, Steven Pinker, I swear, man, I really enjoyed this conversation. This was
me too.
It was wonderful walking through the book the way we did. And I really encourage folks, you know, just take a moment. And this is where a book like Steven's book is really helpful, folks. We get pummeled by even the stuff I do on TV, you know, these talking heads who kind of theorize and subscribe and cringe and make noise about a lot of different things. Every once in a while, it's just good to step back and try to get a little bit more understanding beneath you. And that's what rationality does. It gives us a sense of not only what it is, why it seems scarce, but more importantly, why it matters and why it matters even more right now. The author is Steven Pinker. He is the John Stone Professor of Psychology at Harvard, and he's been our guest on the Michael Steele podcast. It was a real treat, my friend. Thank you.
It was mine. Thank you, Michael.
Absolutely. Folks, that wraps the conversation for this time, but you know me, I'll be back and looking forward to another great conversation. Don't forget to check us out on Spreaker, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts on. You know, I love it when you do that download thing. And please, if you like this episode or any of the episodes that you hear on Spreaker, give us a comment on the Spreaker app. Let me know what you're thinking out there. I like that feedback. It helps me fine-tune my craft, as they say. All right, folks, until next time, be safe, be well. You know what I'm going to say. Get the vax, wear the mask. We're turning the corner. We're almost there, people. Just give us a little bit more runway and we can do this. And until the next time, be safe.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.